For the week of November 27th, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 127, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, back from Nashville, Tennessee, I'm Michael Gill.
So you were in Nashville for the Thanksgiving holiday. How was your Thanksgiving?
It was great. I was in Nashville and Birmingham, Alabama. Went and chopped down a Christmas tree the day after Thanksgiving, Black Friday, and ended up being just a few miles from a cemetery where we went and paid our respects to the man in black, Johnny Cash.
Oh, that must have been interesting.
So there was Johnny Cash and June Carter Cash, and the guy who co-wrote Ring of Fire is buried a few feet away, and the Carter family. And so we went, drove home with a Christmas tree on our roof singing Johnny Cash songs and Christmas carols.
Wow, that sounds kind of exciting.
It was very fun.
Well, now, did you do anything for Black Friday? And now, we should say that in the United States, this past week was the Thanksgiving holiday, and that's what we're referring to. The day after Thanksgiving is a Friday, and it's known as Black Friday, the start of the holiday shopping season. And here in the U.S., people went out of their minds trying to get, I don't know, cheap Xboxes and flat-screen televisions and who knows what. But, Michael, did you do anything for Black Friday?
I haven't actually seen any figures yet, so I don't know how good a day Black Friday was. And, of course, today's Cyber Monday, where people buy a lot of stuff online. I went to the mall on Saturday with my mother in Birmingham, Alabama, and the mall was empty. So this is still a recession, people. I mean, it was empty. It's a very nice upscale mall in a nice neighborhood. You know, parking lot three-quarters empty. Unbelievable. So I don't know how much good it's going to be this holiday season for the stores.
Well, maybe people were just tired out from shopping on Friday.
Yeah, no, there should be more. It's the holiday shopping season. They need people in the stores on Saturday as well.
I'm just glad that here in Los Angeles, we had a little story about a woman that was pepper spraying the people in line. And then And then the store. Yeah, I mean, my question is, now that it's Cyber Monday, when everybody goes online to shop, how can I participate in that with pepper spray? Do I have to email it to people?
You spam people or something, or you block their internet access so that you can get to the websites faster.
Ah, okay. I just don't know how to cut in line on Amazon.
Right. Well, what stories are we going to talk about today when you're not cyber shopping?
When I'm not cyber shopping, first off, we should say you can follow us on Twitter. Showbiz Sandbox is our username. And you can follow us on Facebook. Again, like us. Showbiz Sandbox is our username. But on today's show, just to prove they've lost every shred of originality, Hollywood is now recycling their real-life crime investigations. Just ask Robert Wagner. He'll tell you all about it. They can't even seem to find a new host for the Golden Globes awards telecast, since Ricky Gervais has agreed to insult Hollywood celebrities one more time on next year's show. And it looked like Netflix was finally pulling itself out of its tailspin last week by reviving a much-loved network television show, but even doing that, bringing Arrested Development back couldn't stop its stock price from declining even further. Google, of course, is always trying to prove that it's really hip, just like Apple. Well, this week, or last week, I should say, the company is getting into the online music biz, so we'll see if that makes them any hipper. Of course, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop and end with some correspondence from listeners. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz, who's going to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
Well, it's a very exciting weekend at the box office around the globe. We have worldwide box office figures for you. Of course, we're catching up on 2 weeks of news. Last week, The Twilight Saga Breaking Dawn Part 1 had a massive opening. Though when all is said and done, it will probably end up making just about $700 million at the box office, just like the last two Twilights. Also last week, Happy Feet 2 opened. It had a very poor opening, despite some solid reviews for the George Miller animated film about dancing penguins. And George Clooney's movie, The Descendants, had a very strong opening last weekend at the box office, breaking into the top 10 on just a few screens. It just had a terrific opening. And so now we're at the Thanksgiving weekend. We're combining box office figures in the U.S. from Wednesday to Sunday, because it's a big, huge weekend at the box office in America, along with three-day figures from overseas. It's all a mishmash, but it gives you an idea of what movies people are seeing all around the globe. The number one movie around the world this past week is Twilight Saga Breaking Dawn Part 1. It grossed $113 million worldwide, including the five-day week total here in the U.S. and 3 days around the world. It's at $489 million worldwide and counting. The number two movie around the world is The Muppets, which beat two other big family films to become the second, the number two film at the U.S. box office and the number two film around the world. It grossed $46 million in its worldwide debut, which includes basically North America and Mexico. I'm sure it'll be a big property in England because the show was filmed there for many years, and I think they have a lot of fans. But this is a huge relaunch for the Disney franchise. At number three is Arthur Christmas, a film by Aardman Studios, which are the people who do Wallace and Gromit. It has grossed $24 million worldwide. It's at $39 million worldwide to date and counting. Everybody seems to think that this movie, which got great reviews along with The Muppets and Hugo, the Martin Scorsese film, everyone seems to think Arthur Christmas in particular will have very strong legs leading into the holiday season because of its holiday theme. So people really expect this film to do well over the coming weeks.
I have to say, I saw the film and it is really fun. It's a fun little movie. Mm-hmm. It's worth seeing.
And The Muppets and Hugo apparently also got terrific reviews. So, three family films opening the same weekend, that means a lot of competition for the same eyeballs, but we'll have to see how they pan out. Number four is Happy Feet 2, which grossed another $23 million worldwide. That's at $57 million worldwide to date. It does have good reviews. It's going to be very hard to turn this into a success story. However, they might not lose their shirt once the whole worldwide and DVD are counted, but this is not building on the success of the original Happy Feet, which was sort of an unexpected surprise.
Well, yeah, so unexpected. I mean, when I saw the trailer for Happy Feet, I thought, wow, they're really trying to make a bomb out of an animated film. And the fact that it made so much money in its first 2 weeks, $100 million in its first 2 weeks, was a huge shock, I think, even to Warner Brothers. And now this film in its first 2 weeks is done 44% of that?
Yeah, it's very, very slow out of the gate.
Yeah.
And number five is a movie that's been slow out of the gate but has done quite well overall is Puss in Boots. It's $16 million worldwide. It's at $144 million worldwide to date and counting, but it's got a lot of room to grow overseas. It opened in Spain, where, of course, with Antonio Banderas doing the lead vocals, it was a big hit. And number six is Hugo, the Martin Scorsese film. Why they changed the title from The Invention of Hugo Cabret, I have no idea. But the boringly titled Hugo grossed $15 million worldwide in its debut. It got good reviews like the other two. The studio is insisting that it's going to be play more like an adult film and show really good legs. But I have to feel that this is a bit of a disappointment for them.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's still, for Martin Scorsese, his third highest grossing opening ever.
Right. Well, he's not a commercial director. He doesn't make big commercial films, though in the last few years, his budgets have, increased dramatically. This is his first attempt at a really broad family film, that sort of movie that has a big budget and needs to make big money. It costs $150 million to make, I think. And this is just not a very strong debut. They've tried to spin it eight different ways to Sunday. 75% of the people who saw it in North America paid to see it in 3D, saying, hey, it's Martin Scorsese. He must want us to see it in 3D. But I'm not sure how well it's going to hold.
They really had no star in that film, so much so that Martin Scorsese was the person making the rounds on all the talk shows to hype the film.
Well, I mean, it's a family film starring a little boy and, Ben Kingsley as the film director turned toy store owner, Melier, or however one says his name.
Melier, yes.
It was never going to have a star. It's a family film. Lots of family films don't have stars or they're animated. So that's not really an explanation for why the movie didn't do well.
I guess it also stars Jude Law.
It's a best-selling book. It's a best-selling book. It sold hundreds of thousands, if not millions of copies. Oh, there's a story for you. I wanted to read the book before I saw the movie, and I went to Barnes & Noble. This is a film, a big, huge holiday film opening Thanksgiving weekend. The book is a big bestseller. It sold hundreds of thousands of copies and won, top honors in children's books. A very, very big property. Not a single copy in Barnes & Noble on the Upper West Side. I couldn't believe it.
Maybe you were just late. Maybe they had already sold out of all the
This book has been out for a year, and when a movie is coming out based on a book, usually they reissue the book, maybe with a new cover tied into the movie marketing, or they order more copies of the book. They know it's a big chance to sell more copies. The fact that there weren't piles of the book out front downstairs by the registers stunned me, and I was going to make sure I didn't get the movie tie-in version, which I assumed was around. I wanted to get the original book so I'd look a little cooler. I went up to the children's section. They were stunned. They're like, well, it must have sold. Yeah, of course, it's sold out. A book's been out for a year, but the fact they didn't have enough copies on hand was shocking. We called the Upper East Side store; not a single copy. Downtown at Barnes & Noble, 14th Street, they had one copy. It was gone before I got there. I ended up going to the Strand, which is a used bookstore. They had two copies left, and I bought one of them. If you want to know why bookstores are going out of business, not having this best-selling novel on hand when the movie version is opening on Thanksgiving week, right before the holiday shopping season when everybody's buying stuff, that is, my mind is blown about that fact. That's just unbelievable.
Yeah, poor management.
And it's a book that you have to, it doesn't work as an ebook. It's a combination graphic novel and novel. So there's a lot of text, a lot of images. You can I don't even know if an ebook version is available, but you really want to own it. It's a nice, thick, fun book to hold. It really works as a book, and you really want that print version of it. And they didn't have it in their store.
Well, yeah, that, like I said, poor management.
Unbelievable. Tower Heist is at number 7 worldwide. That grossed $14 million. It's at $72 million and counting. Another movie that's clearly a disappointment. And number 8, one of the big success stories of the year, Intouchables. This is the French comedy we've been talking about that's been a massive success in France. It's about an old man and his ex-con caregiver, a paraplegic or quadriplegic old man and his ex-con caregiver. Crazily high concept. It grossed another $13 million. It's at $75 million in France alone. That is a huge amount. So we're going to be hearing about this movie for a long time to come.
And I think I can't remember who.
Yes, Weinstein's have it.
Yeah,
yes.
They bought the remake rights.
Well, they bought the rights to show the film in the U.S. We assume they also bought the remake rights. I would fall down in my grave right now if they didn't. But yes, they have the right to distribute it in the U.S. We know that at least.
Okay. And we don't want you falling down in your grave. So
we'll have to call
Harvey and have him remake the film in English.
Well, at least get him to buy the rights if he hasn't done so already.
Right. That's true.
At number 9 is The Immortals, the Tarsem Singh film that grossed $12.7 million worldwide. That isn't quite the final numbers. There's a few countries to come in still because there are multiple distributors on this one. But it has grossed $87 million worldwide to date. At number 10 is The Adventures of Tintin, which grossed $11 million worldwide. It's at $207 million to date and counting. Of course, it opens in the U.S. around Christmas. And I'm not sure, but I assume it has quite a few countries to open still. So this will be a month or 2 months before we figure out exactly where Tintin is at. At number 11, unfortunately, is Jack and Jill, the Adam Sandler comedy, which grossed $11 million worldwide. It's at $65 million and counting. At number 12, one of the big success stories is The Descendants, the George Clooney film, which expanded to about 400 screens. It grossed $9 million for a terrific per screen average. It's grossed $10 million to date, and it's clearly positioned itself a la Up in the Air to be a real Oscar contender because it just did terrifically well.
Yeah, I mean, its per screen average was like $16,000, $17,000 per screen. That's pretty good.
Right. I love that the people behind Hugo talked about how they were opening the film small. We didn't expect big grosses because we only opened it on 1,300 screens. I'm like, come on. Like, you can make $40, $50, $60 million on 1,300 screens. So Hugo could have made a lot more. The fact that it was on 1,300 screens did not stop anyone from seeing that film. But The Descendants, it's on 433 locations. It did terrifically well. And it's joined at the art house circuit by a couple movies that opened on, very modestly. The Artist, the French film that we both loved. It's black and white tribute to Hollywood. And it opened on 4 theaters and grossed $210,000 over the 3-day weekend, which is a terrific per screen average of about $50,000. And the same thing is true for David Cronenberg's new film about Sigmund Freud and Jung. That grossed A Dangerous Method, I should say, is the title of the movie. It also opened on 4 theaters, and it grossed $240,000. So those are two art house movies that we'll be looking to expand as they get critical support and end of the year awards list and all that sort of stuff and expand bigger and bigger, hopefully poising themselves to open wide when Oscar nominations are announced in January.
Yes, and I can't stress enough that don't be thrown off by the black and white. Don't be thrown off by the fact that it's a silent film. Go see The Artist. You will thank us for sending you.
Yeah, it's a very fun, crowd-pleasing movie. Anybody who loves movies should enjoy it. It's not anything arty or difficult to enjoy whatsoever. And it will probably be a contender in the Golden Globes under, musical and comedy.
Yes, I would agree with you that I think The Artist, not only will it be nominated for Best Picture in the Academy Awards, but I'm sure it will also be nominated for Best Picture at the Golden Globes. And who will be announcing those? Well, I don't know if he'll be announcing the nominations, but he'll certainly be there at the telecast. But our good friend, I say that as if we know him, Ricky Gervais, who we said last year when we were talking about the Golden Globes the day after they happened last year, we said Ricky Gervais will be back for a third time as the host of the Golden Globes. We were right almost a year ago. And sure enough, over the past 2 weeks, he said he's coming back.
Pat on the shoulder to us. Yeah, it's crazy. He didn't goose the ratings dramatically, but he got a ton of press and attention. Golden Globes is desperate for that. And, why wouldn't you have him back?
Now, the Golden Globes is an award ceremony held by the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, which is 83 entertainment journalists from around the world. And they held a vote with all 83. I guess when you have only 83 people, you can hold a vote with your entire membership.
That's right. It's a pure democracy.
Yes. And only 16 out of the 62 members who voted were opposed to having Ricky Gervais come back. I would imagine one of them was the former president, Philip Burke, who last year got goosed by Ricky Gervais. He said he had to help the HFPA president off the toilet and pop his teeth back in.
Well, that's a one out of three practically, so it's not like a small number. But, you know, sanity prevailed. He was not some sort of outrageously insulting, horrible person. His jokes were not, you know, jaw-dropping. They were just whatever. They were cheeky and sarcastic. What did you expect when you hired Ricky Gervais? They expect more of the same, but we think if he's going to surprise us, he'll try to be really nice.
Yes, he said, expect pedophile jokes and jokes about the Holocaust. Those are the...
Well, nobody's joking about, of course, the Natalie Wood case. She famously died mysteriously. I don't know if mysteriously is quite the right word, but under unusual circumstances, out on a boat with her husband, Robert Wagner, and actor Christopher Walken. And she, we believe, fell off the boat and drowned very tragically. And it's always been a little bit of a mystery around that because she and Robert Wagner were fighting the night before, having words. That's what some people say. And there, of course, were only a few people on the boat. And she was a big movie star who died, you know, rather unexpectedly. And so there's always been a few questions around it. But now, suddenly, out of nowhere, somebody has stepped forward with information. And the LA County Sheriff's Department has announced that they're reopening the investigation into Natalie Wood's death.
Yes, I guess they don't have enough to do here in Los Angeles. They've decided to open up a 30-year-old case.
Well, it's not that somebody came forward with information and they felt it was valid enough that they needed to reopen it. It wasn't a choice of them. They were looking for something to do. The timing was interesting because, of course, she died
Thanksgiving 1981.
Right. So literally 30 years later, almost to the day, they reopened the case. But, you know, they went to talk to the captain of the boat because of comments he made about what happened on board. And they felt that they had to investigate it. And Robert Wagner wasn't contacted by them yet, but says, quote, he trusts they will evaluate whether any new information relating to the death of Natalie Wood is valid and that it comes from a credible source or sources other than those simply trying to profit from the 30-year anniversary of her tragic death, end quote. You have to imagine they felt a little awkward and about the timing, given that it was so, you know, on the dot.
Literally almost 30 years later. Yeah, I mean, what's interesting about this to me is that a couple of years ago, well, actually almost 10 years ago, took several sailing courses with a man named Paul Miller, who runs the, I think it's called California Sailing Academy, and he was, you know, one of the founders of the American Sailing Association, and he's kind of an old salt, literally. And we had to, well, I was part of three students decided to go on and take this bareboat charter course. And we had to sail to Santa Catalina Island, 26 miles off the coast of Los Angeles and the coast of California. And we were moored for 2 days in the isthmus in Catalina, right where this whole incident occurred.
Did you see a ghost?
We did not see a ghost. Paul Miller, though, had that same boat moored there the night of Natalie Wood's death. And, you know, he said, look, you know, every night they would go back to their boat, Robert Wagner and Natalie Wood, and they would be screaming and fighting and, you know, they would always be drunk and you know, everybody in the little isthmus there on all the moorings knew that they were around and that they weren't getting along. And he was one of the first people there on the scene, and it just so happens that he was, at the time, a deputy in the medical examiner's office and an expert on oceanographic accidents. So he was there and wrote a special report on really what more than likely happened, which is that she fell into the water trying to get into the dinghy that was attached to her boat.
Well, the dinghy was banging against the side of the boat, reportedly, and in attempting to secure it, they believe she slipped, hit her head, and fell into the water and drowned.
Right, and actually now they're saying, you know, his report, which wasn't really released until recently, said, and this is Paul Miller's report, said that actually she was more than likely trying to get into the dinghy, fell, was wearing a down coat. The water, I have to say, having had to jump into it in November off of Catalina, it's like knives going into your skin. So the second you hit that water, you lose a ton of mobility.
Plus, she might have been drinking, you know.
Yeah, and she may have been. And so they said that, you know, she actually struggled valiantly trying to get back to the boat.
She struggled valiantly. Who the hell could say that? Who the hell could describe her as struggling valiantly?
Sorry,
nobody witnessed it.
Heroically is the word that was
used.
How
would they know heroically? How would they know how, in what way, shape, or form she tried to get back into the boat?
Based on the...
nobody witnessed her.
Yes, but...
nobody could describe what she did heroically or not. they can speculate, but to give it an average, like heroically and violently, okay,
they speculated heroically based on the bruises on her arm. And they said that, you know, she probably clung on to the dinghy there as it was swept out to sea. But because of the way the wind is at that this time of year, it blows inland, not out. You know, if it was blowing the regular way.
God, I don't want to go over the whole crime investigation.
No, but I mean, I look at this and I kind of go, why are they doing this? I mean, really?
Because somebody came forward and said to the media, blah, 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 blah. The captain made statements to the media stating things that he had claimed he would lie. Robert Wagner asked him to lie and that he now is breaking his silence.
But wait a second.
Whether he was paid, I don't want to discuss it. Whether he was paid for it or not, I don't know. But if somebody comes forward and says in a murder investigation that's still open, I have information that I lied in my previous deposition and I'm now telling the truth, I assume you have a certain obligation to step in and go, well, we'd like to talk to you again. Thank you very much.
But wait,
you
know, first off, the case was closed. The case was closed.
Whatever. It doesn't matter. You reopen it. If somebody goes and says, I lied previously and I was lying about what happened the night this person died and it's a murder investigation, I assume you have an obligation if you become aware of it to go, hey, we'd like to talk to you. What's weird about that?
Nothing. And when you find out that same person is trying to promote a book that they wrote two years ago about the same thing.
You'll have to speak to them. Well, you can't decide in advance you don't believe him.
Okay. Well, yeah. I mean, the captain of the boat has a book that he's trying to promote.
It doesn't mean he's lying. What choice do they have? They don't get to say he's got a book to promote or a TV deal, and therefore we have to assume he's lying.
No, but you can kind of question him a little bit more before.
Well, that's why they're speaking to him. That's what you do.
Right. Well,
now he's going to find, you know, now he knows, I'm sure he has lawyers that, guess what, now you're liable for this and that for perjury for the whatever statements you made before, or if they were under oath or whatever, not, I don't know, but, you know.
That's true.
What can they do? They got to talk to him and find out what the deal is.
That's true. And well, you know, if rebooting Spider-Man wasn't enough, or, you know, relaunching Charlie's Angels for the umpteenth time, you know, now they're rebooting murder investigations here in Hollywood. But, you know,
well, at least they're rebooting Arrested Development, which everybody has been clamoring for ages.
That's right. You know, I was a big fan of Arrested Development. I watched all the episodes when they originally aired on Fox. And it was one of those shows that it was like the little show that could, you know, you really hoped that people would, you know, more people would watch it and that the ratings would increase because it was definitely one of those shows that always seemed to have more people talking about it than the ratings.
It was a cult hit.
Yeah, it was
a very modest hit on the network.
Right. And then all of a sudden they canceled it after three seasons, which is kind of a little shocking since, let's face it, you know, four seasons and you get to go into syndication. You need, you know, those 80 episodes. Needless to say, Arrested Development is in syndication, so it doesn't really matter. It has long been rumored that there would be a movie made of Arrested Development with Mitch Hurwitz, you know, producing and writing the film. And I guess, a couple months ago, Showtime said, well, maybe we'll revive a couple of episodes and make the movie. But none of that happened. Instead, Netflix turned up and
decided. Well, no, a number of people were bidding for the possibility to make it happen or speaking up or offering things. And Netflix was the one that won the opportunity to do it.
Well, I mean, do you think this is smart for Netflix to show up and really get into original content, not only with House of Cards, which is the Kevin Spacey, David Fincher show that they're producing, but now kind of reviving Arrested Development? Is this a smart move for Netflix?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a small, you know, it's a short term investment. 10 episodes, boom. It's a show. It's a known property. It probably lines up beautifully with the people that use Netflix. Anybody who watches this show or is interested will want to rewatch the other couple seasons, which I assume are available on Netflix as well. And so it ties in very nicely with who they are and what they do. It's, you know, quality programming that you can't find easily on a network, but now you can find it there. It can only help them.
A couple of weeks ago, I was talking to two acquisitions executives, one from HBO and the other from Starz. And when I mentioned Netflix, they really just cringed. And they said, it really felt like I had said a dirty word or something. And they just said, look, you cannot tell us you are not our competitor and then go out into original content. That's what we do. We can give you that content later, but don't tell us you're not our competitor and then steal shows away from us.
Well, that's the same problem that Amazon is having as it grows bigger and bigger in actually publishing books. And same thing Barnes & Noble had when it started printing their own line of classic books like, you know, Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn, public domain titles. Publishers were freaked out about that as well. But if Netflix wants to distinguish itself and keep bringing people to it, they need some content that's not available elsewhere. So you have that tug. The producers and the studios want to make their shows available on multiple platforms so that anybody can access it any way they want, whereas Netflix wants stuff that you have to come to them for so that you will pay that monthly fee.
That's right. And, you know, the one little, I don't want to say hiccup, but the one little warning I might issue about this whole thing is that shows like Arrested Development, when they're on a network such as Fox, they are paid for in numerous ways by the, you know, not only retransmission rights now, but also by and syndication down the line, but also because of commercials. And Netflix says we will never put commercials in these shows. So half of the revenue that would normally be available for original content is now gone. Although I guess they're getting it from subscribers.
Well, they're in the HBO business. They're in the business of creating original programming that brings people to subscribe, pay their monthly fee of $9. And HBO, of course, had original shows like The Sopranos, and they also showed movies. So why weren't studios screaming at them saying, oh, HBO is a competitor? You can't tell us you're creating shows, and yet you also want to show our movies on your cable channel. Well, you know what? It's all right. Everything will work out fine. They're a channel or a site that broadcasts all these different programming, and they create some original programming as well. And that exclusive content will bring people, make them feel like they're getting their $9 worth.
Well, now, Ryan Lawler over at GigaOM, he asked, has Netflix overextended itself? Because last week, you know, you'd think that something like this would finally pull Netflix out of its tailspin. That, you know,
it should not turn their stock around and send it soaring. It's just a deal to launch show 10 episodes of a sitcom, but it's a bit of positive news.
It's a bit right. And that's where I was headed with that. And then, of course, later in the week, they said, well, we're also going to sell $400 million in stock and convertible bonds because we need the cash because we have to go expand overseas in Europe and Latin America. But we also have to try and buy some more content. They have, you know, they spent $200 million on buying back their own stock at an average price of $222 per share, which is right now about three times the stock's price.
Okay, so they've made some bad financial decisions. I saw another investor who today just changed their rating of Netflix from negative to neutral. So that was an upgrade. So that's positive news.
That's good.
But, you know, personally, I don't think Arrested Development should come back. I thought three seasons was a terrifically long time for this quirky, weird little show. I don't think it should have run for four seasons or six seasons. I felt like they'd done everything they could with it. I felt like it met a natural end and that we should be happy with the episodes we had. It's not a show that I think you want 100 episodes of. Smaller is better. I mean, the British taught us that with The Office, the original UK Office. 12 episodes, perfection from beginning to end. So I'll look forward to seeing them and I'll watch the movie, but I'm not exactly thinking, oh, golly, we only got, you know, 60 episodes of Arrested Development.
Do you think a movie would have been a good idea? Forget the extra episodes, but do you think?
I don't think a movie's a good idea either. I mean, the movie, the rhythm of the show, the whole thing of it, you know, it's fun. I'll go see it. Hopefully they'll pull it off. But I didn't feel like it was a show that got a good solid run out of a very quirky little premise.
Well, now, okay, that's Arrested Development, and that was on for three seasons. Another show that's in its third season now is a show called Community. And when NBC unveiled their mid-season schedule, there were two shows that weren't on the list. One was Community, a half-hour sitcom starring a kind of an ensemble cast that includes Chevy Chase, and Prime Suspect, the new Maria Bello show. It's kind of a New York police detective show, procedural, if you will. And nobody seemed to be crying about Prime Suspect, but everybody, Twitter was up in arms over the fact that Community was going off the air.
Well, it wasn't on the schedule. It could return later, but, you know, this is crazy. NBC has no hit shows. Last week, not the Thanksgiving weekend, but the week before that, when it got the full TV ratings, except for football and the football-related, you know, preview shows, they had not a single show in the top 40. The Office was ranked number 41. Not one show, not one drama, not one sitcom is in the top 40 of the ratings. NBC is in such free fall. Their entire schedule is in disarray. They have no hits on Thursday. You know, The Office, after growing modestly for a number of years from very modest beginnings, is falling back down. Community is at 8:30 on Thursday. Nobody really watches it. It's not a big – or is it at 8 o'clock? Does it anchor the night?
Good I think Lord. It is at 8 o'clock because they moved –
8 o'clock. That's right, because Parks and Recreation is 8:30, right?
Yes, and I think Up All Night was moved from wherever it is now, I think Wednesday, to Thursdays at 8 because that show is doing phenomenally well.
No, it is not doing phenomenally well. No show on NBC is doing – it is not doing phenomenally. It was not doing well where it was before. They thought it might be a better fit there. It's not even in the top 40 or 50. Up All Night is not doing well.
Well, they're calling it a hit.
Well, who is? You NBC?
Know, no. All of these – all of these television pundits.
Nobody's calling it a hit. It's not doing well. It's not even holding on to its lead-in. It's not doing well at all. It's not a remotely successful success story. Grimm, that's an NBC show, right? That is the closest to a success story they have from the fall season. Grimm is on Friday nights at 9 o'clock. That is an actual, honest-to-goodness, very modest success story. And the other big show that's coming up in the spring that they're hoping will be good is Smash, which is sort of like a Glee set on Broadway. It's about the launching of a Broadway musical. It's gotten good early buzz. It airs Mondays at 10. And they're hoping that will turn into something. But yeah, they do not have a single good bit of news. Not Whitney, not Rock Center with Brian Williams, not Up All Night, not anything.
Let me read you this, because this is from Vulture, which is the New York magazine, okay? They said that NBC's scheduled shift was driven mostly by a very admirable goal, and that is turning Up All Night into a bigger hit. Up has been holding its own on Wednesdays, despite facing monstrous competition from ABC's well-established The Middle, Fox's The X Factor, and CBS's Veteran Survivor. Up was posting better ratings at 8 p.m. than more established NBC 8 p.m. shows on other nights, including the sing-off.
NBC doesn't have a single hit. Of course it was Up All Night is not a success story. They hope it might become a success story. I mean, by NBC's pathetic standards, it's not a complete disaster.
It's right. The most time-shifted comedy on TV right now with
Who
adults
cares?
18 to 49, which Dude. Basically is like saying, hey, it's the show that most people don't want to watch.
It is not the meme as a percentage of its audience, because it's certainly not number one in the time-shifting ratings. That's Modern Family with 3-point-something million. So I don't know. That's not true. Maybe they meant it as a percentage of their audience or something. They're meaning nobody watches it live, but a number of people watch it on DVR. Maybe that's what they mean.
Oh, they say on a percentage increase basis.
Okay.
On a percentage increase basis. So that's that qualifies it.
Right. This is a show that's showing very modest signs of life. All right? That's it.
And Whitney...
NBC has no... Grimm is by far a bigger success story for NBC than Up All Night.
And Whitney...
Whitney is a disaster.
Whitney is behind The Office and it's not holding its numbers. So
Whitney's not doing well. None of their shows are doing. Prime Suspect is a bad show. They're all bad shows. Grimm is doing okay. Up All Night is showing very modest signs of life. It's got sort of a pulse. And frankly, the bar is not high on Thursday. So we'll have to see. But you could say it's showing signs of life, something like that. But what is not showing signs of life are the plans to revive All My Children and One Life to Live online.
Yes, that's right. Well, they're saying, the producers of Prime Suspect are going to go and try and find a cable network, or they're going to shop the show around to different cable networks. Frankly, it would have been better on TNT. All these soap operas that a couple of months ago we said, hey, they're being canceled and there's this plan to move them to online that Jeffrey Quatinetz and Rich Frank, who were these two producers, were going to move them online. It turns out the union said, oh, that's a great idea. Now pay us. And the unions they could never cut a deal with the unions.
It wasn't just the unions. They didn't have enough backers. There's a lot of reasons why this didn't work. They announced something before they had their ducks in a row.
That is true.
Don't blame it on the unions. They would be happy. There are webisodes filmed all the time. People do stuff online. Big stars appear in online programming. Deals could have been made if they had the proper formula in the backing. So don't blame this on the unions. This was two guys who announced something that they did not have a deal set in place for. They said, wouldn't it be great, basically, if we could do this? And we're going to try. They didn't have deals with the actors. They didn't have deals with the unions. They didn't have deals with enough backers to fund it. So they are the ones who failed here, not unions. I'm sure the actors, if they, they probably came to them and said, hey, we'll give you $10 an hour. Whatever they offered, nobody signed on for it. So clearly they were not offering enough incentive to make it happen.
Well, no, because let's face it, doing something on the web is going to be a different model than doing something in broadcast television of any
kind. Absolutely, and
yes.
I'm sure the actors recognize that. But after 30 years of a job, I'm sure they'd like to see that job continue in some form. So I'm sure they would have been open to, something. They wouldn't have expected the same salary.
They didn't have any of the big names, and that was part of the problem. They didn't sign on necessarily. And then when they tried to...
They didn't sign on at all, yeah.
Yeah, and when they tried to say, okay, well, how can we do this where these names will sign on and everybody will be happy, the unions wanted more money than they felt they could actually raise, or than they had raised. They had raised a certain amount, and what the unions wanted was way beyond what they already had in the bank.
Now, again, you're blaming the unions. I don't know what the deal was or the thing, but these guys did not have any deals with anybody in place. They announced a project before they'd spoken to the talent. before they'd lined up enough financing, before they'd spoken to the unions. So these guys announced something they couldn't deliver on, period.
Well, how do we know they hadn't talked to the talent?
What?
How do we know?
Because they didn't have a single person signed. They said, we're going to do All My Children, but we don't have Susan Lucci signed to the deal. Well, who cares? if you haven't signed on Susan Lucci, you don't have All My Children. So don't announce it till you actually have a project that could potentially work.
Well, the New York Times points to two things. They say unable to persuade Hollywood unions or financiers to support the experiment.
Financiers. Yes. Financiers.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
Well, and that's, I guess, really the moral of this story, in my opinion, is you can go from the web to television, but going from the television to the web is a much harder play.
That's a good point.
That's to me is the moral of this story.
Going from search to music isn't that easy either.
That's true. Now, you must be talking about Google, which I kind of understand why they did this. And I was kind of making light earlier that, you know, Google is always trying to show that it's hip. Frankly,
isn't Google hip?
Yeah, I was going to say they're about as hip as you can get, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, I love their, did you look at their Thanksgiving Day little logo thing where you got to play with the turkey and cause the feathers to change and all that?
Yeah, they're what they call a doodle. Yes.
Yes, their doodles are always fun.
Yes. They about 2 weeks ago, they announced their cloud music service, which, you know, you get 20,000 songs you can upload for free and will be available for streaming on all platforms, including on the iPhone. And when you buy music from them, it's at 320 kilobits per second. And to give you some frame of reference there, when you buy music from iTunes, it's at 256 kilobits per second. CD quality is 320.
I didn't even know they sold music, frankly. So they're giving you free cloud service for up to 20,000 songs, which for most people is more albums than they own.
Right. And, you know, the service launched with about 8 million tracks from Sony, Universal Music Group, and EMI. Warner Brothers is still the holdout there.
You mean the 8 million tracks available for purchase?
For purchase, yes. Not for streaming. You can't stream them, I don't think.
Why is it that nobody wants me to have a library bigger than 20 or 25,000? I can't use Amazon unless I break up my library into all these bunch of little pieces because they won't accept you if you have more than 25,000 tracks. I guess they assume you're a thief if you have more than that number?
No, I think it's more a matter of storage capacity. Yeah, storage capacity, frankly. And you can't.
But I mean, Amazon's matching you up, or whoever matches you up with the songs, not Amazon, but Apple matches you up with the songs that are already up there.
Yeah. And by the way, I signed up for iTunes Match. And after I think I had 10,000 tracks on the current hard drive where I kind of uploaded stuff or, you know, did the match. And they say they had to upload 2,700 tracks of the 10,000. And I started looking at some of the tracks they were uploading, and I have a lot of opera and a lot of jazz. All of that was on their service in iTunes. So it didn't match properly. And all of my, you know, tags, my ID3 tags, they were all done beforehand. So they were all pristine. And so iTunes Match, it's kind of like iTunes sort of match.
You like anything that Google has done? Is there done anything different here that you like, or is it interesting, or is it just another competitor?
It's, you know, it's just another competitor. I think that if you immediately open and you can upload 40,000 songs, the next year when you want to announce something, how do you announce, you know, hey, now you can upload 60,000 songs? You know, I think the reason they do that is you have to iterate your product. And so part of iterating the product is allowing you to upload more songs next year.
The one thing I don't like about Amazon is that if you play a song on your like phone or your tablet that you're accessing via the cloud, they start to download it to you, so that you can then play it if you go off Wi-Fi. But if I wanted to download it onto my app, my tablet, or my phone, I would have done that in the first place.
Wait, who does that? Amazon?
I believe Amazon does that, where they match it, and then if you start to play it, they start to download it automatically to whatever device you're listening on, so that you can continue to play the song even if you go out of Wi-Fi service.
It's supposed to be caching it, yeah.
It's supposed to be a plus, but to me, I'm like, no, I don't want that. That's the whole point.
That's never happened to me when I've used the Amazon Music Store. I mean, now I'm using all of them. I'm on Amazon. I'm on Google.
Well, which one's the best?
You know, I haven't really come to that conclusion yet, but I will tell you this. I was really psyched about the way Google Plus. I mean, I bought the new Coldplay album for $1.99. I bought a whole bunch of albums for $1.99 off of a Mayer Hawthorne album, brand new one, $1.99. I mean, how could you beat that price?
Was it a sale? Well, you can. It was a sale to try and lure you to the service.
That's right. And it totally worked. You know, Google's whole thing is, well, you know, if you buy a song from us, then you can stream it for free one time to your friends on Google Plus.
Whatever.
Yeah. I'm like, yeah, that's not really all that interesting to me.
I'll tell you, it's a funny world. When I went to visit the grave of Johnny Cash, when we left, we wanted to hear some Johnny Cash music. I had my iPhone jacked into the stereo of the car that we were driving in to play music, and I didn't have any Johnny Cash on my phone at the moment. In the future, of course, we'll have the worldwide, everything I own will be available automatically and seamlessly. But for now, I had to do a workaround, which was I went to YouTube, searched for Johnny Cash, found some videos with classic audio of his songs, and then played, you know, Ring of Fire and A Boy Named Sue and stuff like that over the radio, using my iPhone and using YouTube as a source of the music.
And you could have done that with Pandora. I would say, you know, the one thing that Google has done that I think is very innovative is they now have this Google Music Artist Hub where artists can just go to Google, upload their music, create their own pages and their own little store, and sell direct to fans. That is new, and it just costs like $25 to register, and then they collect 70% of any sale that is made. That's pretty.
Well, it's not new. I mean, people can set up their own website and sell direct to fans, right? I mean,
well, yes, but to do it on a huge platform, iTunes doesn't let you do that.
Well, it's not. Well, iTunes doesn't let them post. What?
No,
we post on iTunes. What do you mean?
No, you've got to go through a record company. That's what CD Baby is all about. You have to go. You can't just send your tracks in to iTunes and say, "Hey, post me." You have to go through a record company. You have to go through some sort of business. You can't just send them blindly. So if you're an independent artist, you can't just show up.
But aren't there companies that do it for a very modest thing as just a broker, just to make a list available?
Yes, that's what CD Baby does. That's
exactly. Well, what's the difference between that and paying $25 to Google Direct?
Because you pay $25 once, and if you cut 20 albums after that and upload them all to Google, then that's what you do. It's $25. Doesn't matter.
And, can you sell music via MySpace? Not that MySpace isn't dead. I mean, don't people do that now?
I don't know whether you can sell music via MySpace. I think they actually send you off to someplace else to buy the music.
Well, everybody's trying everything, just like Sony in the TV business.
Yes.
Sony has PS3s and homes all over the country. I think they've sold like 18 million units of the PS3.
In the U.S. alone.
And my friends, when I visit them in Nashville, they have their Ethernet cable hooked up from their they don't have a PS3, but they have their Ethernet hooked up directly to the screen. They don't have television, but they do have Netflix and Hulu and Hulu Prime and stuff like that. And they watch it streaming video on their television. The picture quality is terrific. And you can do that with your PS3 as well, of course. You can hook it up to the internet. And Sony just said, hey, maybe we can make something out of this.
Right. I like the way you said Hulu Prime. You mixed up Hulu Plus and Amazon Prime and you just kind of mashed them together.
It's a mashup.
But you know,
so anyway, Sony is proposing to try and do a runaround from the cable companies and said, hey, we're already in your home. We're already sort of a set-top box. We already connect you via the internet sometimes to download new video games and stuff and patches and software updates. Why not send you some television shows as well?
Right. And this is a story from the Wall Street Journal, which says that Sony is in talks with all these media companies about launching this service that would deliver to its PlayStation 3 and, of course, other connected devices like the television. By the way, I had to set up a stereo receiver to give somebody surround sound over the holidays.
I wish you'd come to my house and do mine.
And I'll tell you something. I had to go buy this thing. And these receivers now, they get Pandora directly. They get, Rhapsody directly. It's unbelievable. All the things that go through these, what used to be just for music is now, you know, Flickr goes into these things. Spotify, it's remarkable. AirPlay, Apple's AirPlay, you can go directly from your device to your iPhone device to the stereo. It's pretty incredible. And now Sony seeing that as an electronics, you know, consumer electronics company is saying, well, we want to create an over-the-top TV service as well. You know, going over the top of your set-top box.
So no cable, no satellite, it's just through us.
That's right. That's right.
And what they're doing is saying, hey, you want to bundle your cable channels together in three or four packages and we can sell them to our customers who already have PS3s in their home.
That's right. And they're, you know, with 18 million in the U.S., that's maybe not such a bad move. I mean, there's 25 million Netflix subscribers. So 18 million, if your subscriber base is potentially 18 million, that's a lot.
Well, not compared to, I guess, the 75 million or 80 million homes that have cable, but
well,
it's a start.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a start. And, you know, again, they're going to be competing with DirecTV and Time Warner and Comcast and all those cable companies.
But the idea is they need enough channels in the lineup to make it viable for you to switch and make it cheap enough, or make it for the obscure number of people like my friends who don't have cable but are willing to pay for things like Amazon Prime and Hulu Plus. And then suddenly yes. This would be another bill that they would add to their their sort of make good attempt to duplicate cable without actually paying for cable.
Yes, and I think you'll find that by subscribing to all of these services, you will actually wind up paying more than if you just subscribe to cable.
Well, that's hard. Cable's pretty darn expensive.
That's true, but you know, when you start adding up all those subscription services, I think in the end, to get, you know, your sports and your movies and your
Amazon Prime is $75 a year.
That's right.
So that's $12 a month. No, it's $6 a month.
We're not going to do the math now, are we?
Right. Well, Netflix is $8. That's $14. Hulu Plus is what?
$9, I think, or $7.
A month.
$7. Yeah.
That's $23. That's still a long way from $130.
Wow. Yeah, but you still need internet access. So there's $40.
All right. Well, I think it's a big whoop because they don't have anything lined up. They're just talking about it, and it seems very hard to make that happen.
Well, if you think that's a big whoop, then let me read you some of these other news stories in our lightning round, Big Deal or Big Whoop, where we decide whether some of the top entertainment news stories of the week are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. Randy Jackson, you know, the guy from American Idol, he has been name-checking his work with Mariah Carey for so many years on American Idol, you might already think he's on her payroll. But now it's official, Randy Jackson will be managing the career of Mariah Carey, whose career has had peaks and valleys, but by and large has been quiet since her 2006 smash hit, The Emancipation of Mimi, which sold 6 million copies in the U.S. So is Randy working with Mariah a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop in the scheme of themes, in the scheme of things. It's a full-time job, though. I don't know if he has time to be on Idol and handle Mariah. I mean, I imagine she's a handful. God bless her. But, you know, he's worked with her a long time. He might be the right presence to help direct her back again. She can be back on top. Why not? You know, it's a new world as far as album sales. But 2006 isn't that long ago, and she sold a lot of copies of that album. But I don't know if it's something he can do on the side while filming a TV show and doing everything else he does.
Well, maybe he can buy her a watch, because every time I've had any press event that included her or had to interview her, she was at least a half an hour late, if not an hour or two. With the Best Picture list expanding from 5 to 10 and now anywhere in between, are animated films enough of a presence on the main list to make a separate category unnecessary? It wasn't until 1991 that a cartoon got nominated for Best Picture. And that's Beauty and the Beast, by the way. And 1995, when one scored another major nod when Toy Story got a nomination for Best Screenplay. Since then, 7 more films have seen their screenplays nominated, though no actor has been given the nod for their voice work. Of course, a nomination for Best Costumes is kind of a long shot, but with animated films a regular fixture on the Best Picture list, folks are suggesting the consolation prize be eliminated. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. I'd love to see the consolation prize eliminated because I think it would make a better chance at an animated film actually winning Best Picture. But I think maybe it has to win Best Picture before you eliminate the consolation round. You know, let one triumph as Best Picture. You know, be so good that people can't deny it. Then maybe you can take the away the consolation prize.
Fair enough. The Muppets are back thanks to the hit new film, and now the Jim Henson Company is riding its wave of popularity. NBC just announced it was developing a puppet sitcom called The New Neighbors, spelled N-A-B-O-R-S, not the way you would think. This is a show that has a human family whose next-door neighbors turn out to be puppets. The Jim Henson Comedy developed the pitch. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. It's just a deal to possibly make a show. They haven't greenlit it or anything like that. But I was fascinated when we talked about the movie The Muppets, how the studio was talking, this is really the relaunching of a very, very valuable franchise. And they plan to, you know, creatively bring the Muppets back to life and really, you know, TV, film, you know, their theme parks. This is a very big property that's been dormant for quite a while, and I think they're going to do a lot of imaginative, interesting ways to keep the Muppets back, and that can only help the Jim Henson Company, and I'm always happy for that. So it's good to see them working in some other deals as well.
I know you said that you know, it was a big deal that the Muppet movie that's out now you did so well. It's a big deal for Disney, but that's of course because Disney bought the Muppets.
That's right. Yeah, they own the Muppets now.
Yes. And now, have you seen the Muppet movie, the latest one?
I have
one?
Not. I didn't see any movies. I was just all family doing it old school.
Okay, yeah, you know, because they are very self-referential in the film about how they've been away for a while. Haruki Murakami's new novel shows the power of print. It got a mixed review in the New York Times, but Murakami has a dedicated readership. But since the book is 1,000 pages long, which is, you know, like I like to say, Sunday reading, it makes it ultra-heavy to cart around. Surely those readers who are his fans, would opt for the cheaper digital edition. Nope, not when the hardcover is a beautiful work of art you long to display on your shelf or proudly pull out during a subway ride, just to show how smart you are. Hence, IQ84, which is really 1984 in Japanese, has sold 75,000 hard copies and only 25,000 of the cheaper digital version. And who knows? Someone's probably bought both versions. Michael, is that you? Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. It shows books will have a long life as works of art and objects and, you know, cult things. They're not going to go away anytime soon. There's a lot to be said for digital versions. If I had this book, I'd want the digital version just to be able to read it easily when I walk around the city. But it's, you know, you've got a beautiful cover. Beautiful. It's a work of art in itself, kind of like the Hugo Cabret book, which is really fun. You really want to own that book or graphic novels. This is the future for book publishing. It's a little more boutique. But it's, you know, people want to make that statement and have that book on their shelf. And I'm kind of shocked how much better it's done in hardcover than digital, especially since digital is cheaper. But there you go. That's what happens. You want to let people know you read this darn thing.
In a way, it's like the DVD extras.
Yeah, it's something you're willing to pay extra for. It shows, it's something you can display. You know, it's like having that DVD rather than a digital, probably is a better comparison. You know, you want to have that on your shelf because that's one of your, you want The Godfather on your shelf in a box set because that movie you've watched 1,000 times. It's important to you and you want to display it to people.
The Dark Knight is calling it a day. Actor Christian Bale says that he's done with the role of Batman after the final film in the trilogy wrapped shooting recently. Warner Brothers may have bigger plans for the franchise, but Bale says he and director Christopher Nolan have done it right and should move on. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. You know, it's a big franchise. The first one was, you know, did decently, but you know, the second one obviously was a massive hit. So now they're hoping that the third one will be even bigger or just as big, you know, and gross $1 billion. They would certainly like to see it continue. But I think creatively that Christian Bale's right. You know, you don't want to do 5 or 10 of them to move on. And besides, it makes him available for James Bond when they want to replace Daniel Craig.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't think that Christian Bale or Christopher Nolan would do this beyond 3 films. I think they even said they wouldn't. So this is not news to me.
Yeah, they've always conceded it as a trilogy. But, you know, when it's that big a success, it's hard to walk away. And sometimes if you feel like one of them's not done really well, like with Spider-Man, Tobey Maguire and Sam Raimi wanted to do a fourth one to end it right, but weren't given that chance. So here's a case where they felt like they got to make the 3 films they wanted to and are going to walk away from obviously very big paychecks.
That's right. Well, they'll move on to, you know, paychecks in other films, I'm sure.
they'll get by.
Yes. TV has a terrible history of relaunching old TV shows. Just ask the producers of Charlie's Angels. But that's never stopped them before. Recent successes like Battlestar Galactica prove that the worse the original, the more luck you might have with a remake. That's the plan for The Munsters, the goof sitcom that debuted just 1 week after The Addams Family back in 1964 and proved a massive but very short-lived hit. Now Brian Fuller, the creator of Pushing Daisies, yet another unsuccessful show, will work on a more serious, yes, a more serious, hour-long reimagining of the show. Fuller is also developing a TV series about serial killer Hannibal Lecter, because that's something I want to see every week. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, I watch Dexter every week, so I guess I shouldn't make fun of Hannibal Lecter, though I think that show should be on the Food Channel. But anyway, I'm here through Tuesday. It's just, this is a big whoop. It sounds like a bad idea, but I really did like Pushing Daisies, and Brian Fuller's an interesting talent. So I'm certainly intrigued to see what he does with it. Clearly, they're massively rethinking it if it's going to be an hour and somehow more serious. I suppose it's the plight of people who don't fit in, but you never know.
South Park has just been renewed for 5 more seasons by Comedy Central. This will keep the show going until 2016 and its 20th season. That means if they could launch another feature film, Trey Parker and Matt Stone could have a hit TV show, a hit movie, and a hit Broadway musical running at the same time, something that has probably never happened before for one creative entity or actor or director, which may be redundant, but who knows. So where's that Team America sequel, guys? Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal. I slightly worded this poorly. They had already been renewed through 2013, and now they push it to 2016. So it's 5 more years from where we are right now, 5 more seasons. They just extended the contract 3 years.
That's right.
So that's 20 years. That's a long time. You know, I'd love to see the numbers on, who wouldn't want to see the numbers on a lot of shows, but South Park, it's not a big hit. I mean, Tosh 2.0 gets more ratings than South Park. Tosh 2.0 reaches more viewers than South Park, which blows my mind.
Well, wait a second. I think it's Tosh.0, not Tosh 2.0.
What's it called?
Tosh.0.
Oh, Tosh.0. Whatever. It's a stupid show. But anyway, because I'm not 12, I don't like it. But that gets more viewers nightly than South Park does, which boggles my mind. So, but what this show does as far as a property and the merchandising and the online and all that stuff, you know, it works in a lot of interesting big ways for Comedy Central. And it's obviously a signature show for them, and they want to keep it going. So, you know, good for them.
And when it does hit 20 years old, I will actually start using a cane, I suppose, because I remember when the Christmas card that started it all, this little 5-minute, you know, Jesus versus Santa Claus Christmas card with these little kids that were cursing at one another, started making the rounds in Hollywood in 1995.
You are old.
Yeah. And then they said, oh, you know, this is so funny. We should turn it into a TV show. Well, if it's turning 20 years old, that means, anyway. Rocky is going to have to start working on his jabs, his hooks, and his tap dancing because Sylvester Stallone, I can't even say it, Sylvester Stallone is turning his fabled movie into a musical. The show opens in Germany in November of 2012 because everybody opens in Germany before going to Broadway. And it features a top-notch creative team, including Tom Meehan of the producers doing the book and the team of Ahrens and Flattery. Flaherty?
Flaherty, yeah.
Flaherty. Of Ragtime doing the songs. But don't worry, it won't be all original music. Rocky will include the theme music as well as Eye of the Tiger. Is this a big deal?
Somewhere Survivor is launching a comeback tour.
Yeah, big deal or big whoop, Michael. I can't help but laugh reading this whole thing.
I think it's wunderbar because they're going to be in Germany opening up Rocky the Musical. I assume they'll be using the plot line where he faces oh, no, that's Russia. So he won't be facing Dolph Lundgren.
No.
It'll be the original story. They've refocused it on the love story. That's sort of the driving force of the musical. That's where the heart comes from. Stranger things have happened. And Aaron's and Flaherty are a big Broadway success story. So they did Once on This Island and Ragtime. So it's an interesting pairing. And I'm intrigued to hear what they'll do with it.
Shows can build slowly, like NCIS. Debut as blockbusters and remain on top for years, like ER, or they can get tons of press and debut with massive buzz, but seem like old hat after a few years on the air. That's what has happened to Glee, which is falling hard in its third season. The show is often down? Well, I guess so. Often down some 30% in overall ratings and 40% in the key 18 to 49 demographics, or demos as we like to call them in the biz. It's still a massive generator of singles and attention, but clearly the bottom? How about the bloom? Is off the rose. With creator Ryan Murphy launching new dramas and sitcoms all over the place, could Glee be gone by next year? Will the stars want to leave the show and graduate high school this season and not be in spinoffs or the like next year to maintain whatever cool factor the show gave them? Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a very big deal. Last season was a bust creatively. They're back and forth this season. It's a little better, I think, but the numbers are way, way down. People, I mean, 40% in the key 18 to 49 demos. That's kind of shocking how quickly people have gotten over it. I don't like how they've dealt with a number of the characters. I feel like they've lost their way. And it's a case where you have a great show and then you go off and do 20 other projects rather than focusing on what is a full-time job, creating a weekly musical on television. You should not be doing other dramas and sitcoms. I hate it when creators of TV shows do this. I think he's really blown a great opportunity to create a really good show. You know, it's not a great show. It's a really fascinating show. It's a signal show in television. It will always be memorable for a lot of different reasons. But, you know, if he'd stuck to his knitting, he could have created a really great show that you'd want to watch again and again. But I think he's really lost the thread on this one.
Audiences are
responding. And I can't believe how quickly they've turned on it.
Most major publishers have pulled out of a lending library plan for ebooks, and the remaining one, Random House, is actively reconsidering its involvement. As with traditional books, ebooks have restrictions on how often they can be loaned, though the terms vary from publisher to publisher, and no one is happy yet with any proposed standard over how it should work. Plus, publishers are worried that in some approaches, the libraries send customers to Amazon to finish obtaining the borrowed ebook, giving the retailer and nascent publisher another leg up on everyone else. Big deal or big whoop, Michael? Let me guess. Big whoop. I mean, big deal.
It's a big deal because... Yeah. You know, the libraries announced this deal with Kindle to try and make borrowing ebooks from libraries more seamless and easier to do. It's something that they should be doing, but the publishers are freaking out over it. That, you know, they announce it and then they've all started pulling out right away. Penguin was the last one to pull out, and now Random House may be the final of the big six to do so. They've got to figure out how this works. Some publishers say, hey, if you buy an ebook, you can only loan it 26 times, and then you have to buy another ebook. in order to loan it out again, because they think after 26 times the wear and tear is so much that you'll, you know, they want to somehow prevent libraries from loaning ebooks willy-nilly. But they already have restrictions. If they buy an ebook, they can only loan out one copy. They can't loan out 1,000 copies.
Right.
Straightforward ways that this needs to work. They need to work with libraries. Libraries spend billions of dollars a year on books, both print and digital. And what you keep hearing from publishers is, oh, they're going to be killing sales. It's like, you know what? They are a sale. They support communities. They encourage reading. They spend billions of dollars on books, and they need to work with them to make sure that they can remain vital and relevant to their community.
Well, you know, as the world transitions to digital platforms and digital media, they're, you know, everybody's trying to figure out the right way and the wrong way to do this. But I can guarantee you the wrong way to transition your business into the digital world is to try and treat it like it's traditional, tangible business.
Exactly. You got to rethink everything.
That's right. And to say, oh, well, the wear and tear on this digital item would have been too much, does not work.
Right, because, and of course, we know that they loan out regular books a lot more than 26 times before they're so worn out they have to buy another copy. So to randomly choose 26 times to some, okay, now you got to buy it all over again. It's just moronic.
I agree. But that concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us right along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, this week, hold on to your hats. We're going to talk about copyright, and now as it's being called, copy fight. Okay, so a lot of news over the last 2 weeks about two bills that are in the U.S. legislature, which is known as Congress. There's the Protect IP Act, which it stands for Preventing Real Online Threats to Economic Creativity and Theft of Intellectual Property. That's kind of a mouthful. And that bill is in the Senate. On the other side of Congress, over in the House of Representatives, we have something that's known as SOPA, which is short for Stop Online Piracy Act. So you have these two bills making their way through Congress. They obviously have to be merged at some point because you can't pass two different bills on the same subject.
No, that's the whole point. They come together in meetings and work it out and come up with one big bill that both sides then approve. Yeah, right. Everybody knows that.
Now, there's been a lot of controversy over these bills, including now some of the, you know, people who once backed it, like Nancy Pelosi, saying, you know what, this whole SOPA thing, it's not working out for us.
Well, basically, what they're trying to do is say, we know that there are websites overseas that do nothing but pirate and illegal content. They offer Hollywood movies, they offer music, they do this and that. People are accessing them to get free copies of copyrighted material that they shouldn't have. We want to have some way of saying, all right, shut them down.
They can't
go to those countries and do it. They're protected. They're in Russia or they're in some Asian country or somewhere where they don't have legal ability to step in and make those countries shut those websites down. And so they're trying to come up with some technological fix. And what they've decided here in general is that the Justice Department, once it's aware of a pirate website, would go to the courts and say, this website is dealing in illegal pirate information. We want to shut them down, which would mean blocking U.S. servers from accessing that website. So if you did a search for them, it wouldn't show up. If you tried to go to the website, it would not be there. It just wouldn't work. They would sort of remove that domain name from the servers or whatever
that's right.
In the U.S.
That's right. They're called domain name servers. And they resolve
DNS. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. They resolve a web name or a website address like Amazon.com to its numeric value.
Now, some people look at the law and say, well, now it looks like here that if in some versions of the law, which are in each house, well, if there's one page of pirated material, does that mean you can shut down YouTube or does that mean you can shut down Google or how much of the website has to be illegal? How much of it has to be proved? What standards do the feds have to meet before they can go to the courts and say, OK, this is what we believe. We have enough evidence. So it's a very complicated of how it would actually work.
That's right. And what they're saying is, you know, if you look at these bills and read them literally, then anybody that points to an infringing website could be taken down. Not the infringing website, but the people who point. So Google, effectively, could be taken offline because they point to some website that has illegal content on it, unbeknownst to Google.
And another problem would be that third-party people would sue to try and extort money from you and say, hey, we look like you're linking to this, and so they get money, shake you down for money while threatening with shutting down your website altogether. Because you somehow link to a third-party system that somehow has a link to pirated material. It's all very sort of vague and unclear how it would work. And some experts say you can't just remove these DNS names. You can't remove these domain names. Everybody's supposed to have the same domain names all over the world, right?
Right. And well, you start to
eliminate ones and block them, that creates all sorts of weird havoc.
Well, you break the internet, effectively.
What does that mean, break the internet?
Well, because then the internet, which is right now, it's one giant internet, and it's end-to-end. So you can reach out to anybody else online and reach them directly without going through, you know, jumping through hoops. And what they're saying is, and this is what Elliot Van Buskirk of Evolver FM asks, do we really want to break the carefully constructed end-to-end nature of the internet, the very thing that makes it special and different from, say, television, to take down a few overseas sites facilitating the piracy of content created in the U.S.? Do we really need a precedent that lets attorney generals break the internet at the behest of certain industries, especially when the internet comes in so handy for so many other things?
So there's a lot of confusion. And of course, there's variations on each bill in both parts of Congress, and they'll all get resolved and you can make changes and advise. A lot of the technical stuff that people raise and the issues that they raise, clearly the intent is not to shut down Google or YouTube, but you've got to be careful what law you pass, because if that's what the end result could be, then someone could step in and use it in nefarious ways, or it could be interpreted literally until you have to go back in and pass a new law to correct the mistakes you've made. But my big question to you is, if there is a pirate website in Russia that is doing nothing but broadcasting Hugo and Happy Feet 2 and the Muppets to people worldwide for free, what simple thing can we have done to stop? And we clearly want to, we're talking about places that we know are pure pirates. What should be done, or how can you block them, or how can you stop them?
Well, I think if I had the answer to that, I'd be a wealthy man. It is very, very hard. And that's really one way you can stop them is make them harder to find. So going to Google and saying, look, you've got to take those sites that you know are infringing, you have to take them off the results.
Once you've gone to a court and proven with a reasonable standard that they are pirate sites, you can't just have companies going to Google and saying, hey, we don't like this website, you got to take it down.
No, I mean, you could actually start to effectively do it through technology by, you know, bombarding them with denial of service attacks. But then that gets tricky because, you know, the same weapon that you use against somebody else can be used on you. So you have to be very careful how you deploy those kinds of tactics.
Though I love the internet and we want to have fair use and we want to have net neutrality, we don't want to have, you know, the issue. One of the big issues here is Google responsible for the links, for the sites that it links to? And the answer should be no. The phone company is not responsible for things I say over the phone. The post office is not responsible for things I write to someone. And Google should not be responsible for the sites that it links to via search engines. You know, it's not posting, it's saying it's there, but it should not be held responsible or be obliged to act or, you know, move on what is there, because it's not its stuff.
Right. And just last week in the EU, some court overturned a verdict which made the ISP, the internet service provider, responsible for the traffic that was going through its pipes. And they said, wait, you can't do that. I mean, just because the guy gets on the bus doesn't mean you know he's a bank robber. So, right. You know, you can't do that. So, which of course the MPAA and the, all of the recording industry, they hated that, having that verdict overturned. But that's effectively what we're saying here is, you know, where is the safe harbor here? All of these industries, the recording industry, the music industry, the television industry, and the movie industry would all like it that ISPs kind of stopped piracy, you know, at the
but
source.
It's not their job.
But it's not their job. That's right.
So I'm sympathetic to all those complaints, but I do say, hey, there's got to be some common sense thing. We know this guy is purely illegal. There has to be something that can be done without breaking the internet to stop them or to make it much harder for them. So somebody figure that out who's listening to the show, email in the solution and we'll send it on to the feds.
That's right, because we have, a line in into the Justice Department. We can get anything you want passed.
But now, send it to dirt@showbizsandbox.com.
Yes, you can. dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. And that's just what Raul in Oregon did. Now, before we read Raul's email, I would like to personally thank, how do you pronounce it?
The Jive Mance.
Yeah, the Jive Mance for his positive review on the Zune Marketplace and for calling us, quote, this is a quote, the best media business podcast. Thank you very much. Now, we do have an email from Raul in Oregon. Michael, do you want to read it? Do you want me to read it?
Well, why don't I read it?
Okay.
The email is addressed specifically from Raul to Sperling. Hi, Sperling. I'm a big fan of Showbiz Sandbox. I consume a lot of video podcasts, mostly about tech, but but I always make time to listen to Showbiz Sandbox every week when I go to the gym. I first learned about your show when you made an appearance on one of the Twitch shows. Maybe it was Tech News Today way back in January. I was disappointed not to see a new Showbiz Sandbox in my queue this week, yet lo and behold, there you are on Framerate. I appreciate your knowledgeable insight into the entertainment industry. Keep up the good work. Best regards to you and Michael Giltz, too. From Raul in Oregon. So thank you, Raul, for writing in. We certainly appreciate your comment, and I'm a big fan of Sperling, too.
Well, thank you very much, Michael. You know, if it's not enough pressure to do the show every week, now we have to do it just so that Raul stays in shape.
That's right. That's right. Got to be healthy.
But now if you want to download our show or subscribe, you can do that in the Zune Marketplace, as we just said, on Stitcher.com or in iTunes. You can rate us and review us in all of those places. You can follow us on Twitter. Showbiz Sandbox is our username. You can like us on Facebook. Again, Showbiz Sandbox is the name to look up. All of those links, as well as links to, say, I don't know, email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com, or you can call us. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. All of that information, as well as links to all of the stories that we discussed on today's episode, can be found on our website. And the address of our website, which does resolve through DNS servers, is
for the moment,
until somebody decides we've pirated something somewhere, showbizsandbox.com. Now, the music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael can be found, well, either at the side of Johnny Cash's grave or on his website, michaelgiltz.com. That's where you can find links to all of his work on Huffington Post and elsewhere. Some of my writing can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.